So my name is Niall of Archer, for those of you who don't know me. And I want to pick up from where Maitre Bandhu left us, discussing faith. I want to look at faith a little bit more. And I'll talk for a bit, and then I'll open it up for questions and see if we can have a little bit of time for questions as well. So the Buddhist word that is sometimes translated as faith is Shraddha. And actually faith isn't a very good translation of Shraddha. The reason it's not a very good translation is because in our culture, faith has lots of connotations that can come from theistic religions, which aren't Buddhist. They're not Buddhist connotations. So it can be a word that's already very heavily loaded for us. And in a certain sense, it would be better to just drop the word and start to explore Shraddha and find out what Shraddha means. So at least we're doing it in a way from a Buddhist perspective, learning to look at this quality, this Buddhist quality, through Buddhist eyes. That's the only way to approach it. I came from a Hindu background, and it's even worse, because Shraddha is a Hindu word as well, and I've had to relearn how to think about Shraddha that isn't from a Hindu perspective. And if you're from a Christian perspective or Muslim perspective, there will be some sort of relearning. So I'm going to use the word Shraddha rather than the word faith. Although there is another translation of Shraddha sometimes that I quite like, which is confidence, trust. Confidence, trust. And that comes closer to, I think, what Buddhism is getting at. Confidence, trust. Rather than blind belief. Yeah? So if you think about confidence, trust, that's perhaps closer to what Shraddha is about. So in my little group, we were talking about trust. Just before tea, and Wilson was saying, well, we all have to trust things. So when you turn, you had the example, Wilson, of when you turn on the light switch, there's a certain confidence trust that there is electricity going round the building, or the lights will come on, or even sort of walking along the road, you have a certain confidence trust that the earth is going to support us. You know, you're not going to suddenly fall flat on your face or through the floor or something. There's confidence trust all the time, actually. And some of it's more founded on experience, and some of it's a little bit less founded on experience. So the first time you do something, when you have a new experience, it probably takes a little bit more of a leap of confidence, a leap of trust, to do something, yeah, for the first time. I mean, kids have confidence trust, don't they? I remember as a kid going on fairground rides and having bags of confidence trust that the thing wouldn't throw me off, roller coasters wouldn't collapse, and you know, those big wheels wouldn't fall out of your side, so rock this thing. It's like, I don't have so much confidence trust in fairgrounds anymore, and I don't like fairground rides. And I definitely notice there's more experience that says, well, that's shaken my confidence trust at some level. Yeah. So experience can colour our confidence trust one way or the other. We can either have experiences that confirm our confidence, or that in a way shake it, undermine it. So, the reason that we're looking at Shraddha, at this confidence trust, is that it's very, very allied, or it's very linked to wisdom in Buddhism. So Maitre Bandhu was talking about three levels of wisdom, three levels of prajna: listening, reflecting, becoming. Listening, reflecting, becoming. And Shraddha is said to be a prefiguration of wisdom. Yeah? So this confidence trust is said to be the seeds of wisdom. So as we deepen confidence trust, as we deepen it, and there's a sort of path of confidence trust that we can walk down, as we pursue that, as we walk down it, what also deepens is wisdom. And at some point it turns into wisdom. And you can't tell when it shades into something that's wisdom. Yeah? So confidence trust is, or Shraddha, is in a way where we start from very often. It's where we start from. And we can all access it. Shraddha is said to be an innate faculty. It's not that we don't have it. Everybody has it. If we've got human consciousness, innate in human consciousness is the capacity for Shraddha. Yeah? It's innate in us. But what Buddhism says is that we can consciously develop it. We can consciously develop it. As we consciously develop it, what arises is wisdom. At some point, what arises is wisdom. So it's very, very important to look at this faculty of Shraddha. And it's very important to distinguish it from a theistic version of faith, which is like often like blind belief, where you just have to have faith in some sort of theistic creator God thing. And you've got necessarily no evidence or proof or approach to that experience of God other than what somebody else tells you. So it's quite different from that, because Buddhism, remember, is something that we have to experience for ourselves. Okay, so what I want to do is I'm going to go on to examine three different types of faith. But is there just... I'm just going to pause there and see if there's any question on this kind of confidence trust. Does that sort of make sense to you? Or does it still... Are there questions left? Yeah.
Well, I've got one question, because someone in our group used the phrase confidence trust, but I used the phrase confidence doubt.
Yeah.
Because I think with faith, it goes hand in hand with doubt. Because I'm often wary of people who are too certain of something,
yes.
You know, too sure, and I think it's often better to wait and see and to watch things.
Yeah.
You know, a good part of, I think, faith is doubt, is not certainty. So that sort of, I suppose, is my confusion with the term confidence trust.
Yes.
It could be confidence doubt equally, an equally healthy expression.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. It's very interesting that doubt in Buddhism isn't necessarily a negative thing.
Yeah.
It can be actually a very positive thing if it's the sort of doubt that helps you clarify something.
Yeah.
And... the process of clarifying something. So Maitreya Bandhu said that a very common Buddhist teaching is that all things are impermanent. That is the nature of everything. And I think it's worth questioning that. If that questioning is for the purpose of clarification. So really look at our experience. Look for something in our experience that doesn't seem impermanent, for example. Yeah? Maybe that's not a very good example because everything so obviously is impermanent. But I could tell you that, or Maitreya Bandhu said that there are experiences that we can have that go beyond our normal level of consciousness. Yeah. Well, that's worth questioning. It's worth saying, well, is that true? Is that true? How can I know? And the healthy questioning would be a bit like scientific questioning, where you posit, there's some sort of premise that a theory tells you, but then you have to test it. Yeah, you have to question it, and you devise ways of testing it. And if the results are in line with the theory, then you can have a bit more confidence, a bit more trust. And if not, then the theory is false. So Buddhism very much encourages that sort of testing and that sort of questioning. So it says that meditation will lead you to more positive, more meaningful, calmer, more lucid, more happy, more loving states of mind, more expansive states of mind. But unless you've actually meditated, you don't have to believe that. But the only way to find out for yourself is to meditate and try it. So it's that sort of doubt that is really helpful, a clarifying doubt that's willing to also try things out. What's not helpful, and Buddhism makes this distinction, is another type of doubt which is called vichikitsa. And vichikitsa is just an undermining doubt that's already decided that this is a load of nonsense. And it's just trying to undercut with a sort of cynical voice anything that seems to lead to a greater confidence trust. So it's a cynical doubt that doesn't really want an answer and isn't prepared to try things, has already decided and just undermines. Yeah? So perhaps we're familiar with both types of doubt in our experience. A positive questioning that's willing to test things and try things and confirm for ourselves, but isn't going to be gullible until we've had the experience for ourselves, versus this negative, cynical voice that just says, now there's nothing to bother about. And you can test it. Well, you can see the two, I mean, quite clearly in other people, and sometimes it's harder to see in ourselves, but you can see that, can't you? We live, I think, in a quite cynical age, so probably all of us will have some degree of vichikitsa. Actually, it's said that you do. If this side of enlightenment, we've got the negative sort of doubt. So you can probably, in a way, you don't have to get upset about that. You just look for it and notice it when it happens and try not to let it undermine you. Any other questions on this confidence trust before I look at the three types of faith? Yeah. Yeah.
And goes along and then at one time.
So turns into wisdom.
I know it's experimental and I know it's one's experiment or something.
Yeah.
But if one knows what qualities to look for, then we can work towards it.
Exactly.
More. So can you say more about it?
I can. And that leads me very nicely onto these thank different you. Types of faith. So thank you for that. So there are different, Buddhism's very, very good at sort of analysing these different mental states like Shraddha. And there are different analyses, and I'm just going to look at a couple of them. The first one I just want to touch on, and then I'm going to look at the second one a bit more deeply. The first one that I just want to touch on is that in Buddhism, Shraddha is based on, you can say it's based on intuition at first, yeah, and then reason. And then experience. So by intuition, Shraddha starts as this sort of urge, almost this imaginative sense that yes, there is more, that there's some value to be found here. For example, in meditation, you might have this instinct or this intuition that meditation might be useful. You might have read something about Buddhism and it might have intuitively felt true to you. But you don't know it for yourself in experience, and as yet you haven't really thought it through with reason. It's just an impulse. Yeah? And Buddhism takes those impulses very seriously. It takes them very, very seriously. So for me, a lot of my Shraddha in my early life, in my teenage years, was just intuition. I thought I knew there was something more. I had a sense of that. I didn't know what, and I couldn't have articulated it. I just thought, there's something. Yeah? And when I read books on Buddhism, I kind of thought, oh yeah, there's something here. And I couldn't say what. So it's just intuition. So it's intuition. But then Buddhism says, faith is also based on reason. Shraddha is also based on reason, I should say. And reason is a way of testing whether things are true or whether they are potentially true. So Buddhism says, think about the teachings of Buddhism, learn about them, listen and reflect. This is where you use your reason. Partly, those first two levels of wisdom are about listening and reflecting, are about using your reason. So be genuinely open, rather than prejudiced in that way of being a poisoned pot or a cracked pot. Be genuinely open, but not sort of gullible. Use our reason. Let's use our reason to see, does this make sense? So is does generosity and metta lead, well, seem like they are a better way of living? And if they do seem like a better way of living, why? Why isn't it better to just try and go for what I want to make me happy? Why bother to develop kindness? Why bother to try and be more altruistic? Question, yeah? See what Buddhism says about the answer. Because Buddhism, it's quite an important question in Buddhism. Why bother, as it were? Why bother to be more ethical? And Buddhism says that that's because it leads you towards the way things are. And the way things are that we're not separate in the way that we think we are. So when we're more ethical, we're moving towards a realization of the way things are. Does that make sense to you reasonably, even though you don't know that for sure? Yeah? So we use reason to build confidence, trust. But that requires some effort because it requires listening and it requires reflecting. And then thirdly, confidence, trust, Shraddha is built on experience for ourselves. So we not only use reason, but we actually try and practice ethics. We actually try and practice meditation. And we test it. And we test it over a period of time. Some sort of period of time. Preferably, for me anyway, for a lot of people, the real test came when I went on retreat. That was when I could test it properly. And it was only a 10-day retreat. Sometimes you see people test it on a weekend retreat and it seems to work. And then more generally, when you've been meditating for 6 months, well, see, have you changed? Has it worked in your experience? Does it actually do what it says on the tin? And if it does, that's a bit of experience that you can strengthen your confidence, trust, strengthen your shraddha. So intuition, reason, and experience are all important. Yeah. Reason, in the sense of thinking and reflecting, is very important, but ultimately the Buddhist experience goes beyond reason. So reason is important, and we're trying to go beyond it. Does that answer your question a little bit? Okay, well, I'm going to say a bit more then. So that's one model: intuition, reason, experience. So another model is three different types of faith, three different types of Shraddha. There's the deep faith, there's the lucid faith, and there's the longing faith. Deep faith, lucid faith, longing faith. I should know the Sanskrit for them, but I don't. Well, I do, actually. I know the one for longing faith, which is abhilasha, which is a lovely word. Do you know? You don't know. So, never mind. So we've got deep faith, lucid faith, and longing faith. And those three types of Shraddha are, in a way, three. I like to see them as three different ways into this experience of confidence, trust, of Shraddha in its fullness. So first of all, the deep faith. The deep faith is when we have some sort of conviction about what is true. And it's the reason it's called deep faith is because it's a deep conviction. It's not just an intellectual idea, but somewhere in our being, in our bones, we know something is true. We have a response to something that is true. When somebody speaks the truth and we instinctively know, that's this experience of deep faith. We've all got this capacity for deep faith because we've got radar out for truth, yeah, and we're quite skilled at having a response to truth. So this is a sort of conviction that yes, there's truth. Now obviously there's a spectrum. So sometimes that conviction is deeper than other times. It's deeper than other times. So from a Buddhist point of view, we're trying to have a deep faith towards the truths that Buddhism is telling us. So it's not just when somebody tells us the truth. It's about truth, about nature of reality. It's a conviction, a deep conviction that the Buddhist worldview is somehow true. Yeah? So Maitreya Bandhu was saying that the Buddhist worldview is that somehow we've got our experience very wrong. We've started from a wrong assumption, and we're wandering round in this dark room. We have a picture of it, but actually it's wrong, very wrong, and therefore we cause ourselves suffering. Buddhism's also saying that there's a way out. In a way, you can turn the light on in that room and see what the room is really like, and then you don't have to bump into the furniture. Yeah? There is a way out of that unnecessary pain that we cause ourselves. So Buddhism's saying we've got something very, very wrong about the nature of our experience. And that wrongness is very, very, very deep. It's instinctive, right down in our bones. It's sort of been bred into us by millions of years of evolution. Because that very wrongness is when we have a sense that we're separate from the rest of the universe, that we've got a fixed sense of separate self. And that ultimately is wrong, Buddhism says. And it says that if we can free ourselves from the delusion of that, if we can turn the light on, then not only do we sort of see things differently, but we experience everything very, very differently. We experience everything very, very differently. So fear goes. Fear just disappears, because all fear is ultimately about fear of annihilation of this sense of self. And if there isn't a sense of separate self, fear disappears. All sense of wanting disappears. But instead, it's not just this numb, blank void that we are left with, but when the wanting disappears, we're filled with contentment and bliss. That's why there's no wanting, because it's almost like everything that we've ever wanted is there all the time, already, because there's no... we're not separate. If we really identified with the whole of the cosmos and the whole of the universe, who is there to want anything and what is there to want? There's everything. So wanting disappears, fear disappears. A sense of freedom is said to arise because there's no, in a way, no boundary. Our consciousness isn't bounded by our sense of this physical body. Actually, mind doesn't have to be bounded. And a freedom arises that transcends the limitations of the body. So in our body, we're not able to do everything that we'd like to do. We can't fly, for example. But in our mind, we can. Consciousness isn't bounded by form, by body. So they're just some of the qualities that are said to arise when we see things as they really are. So it's really worth doing. It's said that we've got something very wrong, and what a pity. What a pity, because actually all of this richness could be ours. So when we have a conviction, when we have a sense of that, an intuition of that, that's deep shraddha, that's deep faith. It's an emotional conviction. It's not a rational conviction, it's an emotional one. Does that make sense? That's deep faith. That's the first type of faith. And you don't have to be a Buddhist to kind of have that sort of faith. Everybody will have moments of it. I can remember as a kid, I was taken to Canada. I had some relatives in Toronto, and we went to see the Niagara Falls. And I was quite young, probably about 9, and maybe a bit older, I don't know. And the Niagara Falls were overwhelming. They were overwhelming. You can go on the... Has anybody been to Niagara Falls? And you can go around the Maid of the Mist. And, well, it sounds quite sweet now, this boat that you get into, you put your wellies on and your raincoats on, and you go round the horseshoe at the bottom of the falls. But for me, it was an experience that in a way transcended everything else that I'd ever experienced before. It was overwhelming with wonder and awe, and I couldn't articulate it at the time, but it stayed with me, it haunted me in my dreams, that experience of being at the bottom of these Niagara Falls with this wall of water, this horseshoe of water, just powerfully pounding down. And for a while, I think that was my strongest experience of deep Shraddha. So it doesn't have to be a kind of Buddhist experience, but what I experienced there was a lack of separation from my environment. I experienced a sense of wonder. I experienced a sense that there was more to life that I couldn't understand. There were forces that were bigger than I was, and here it was, just as water. Water that I had just taken for granted. There was something in the universe that was much, much bigger and vaster. Yeah? And somehow I could get lost in that. So it doesn't have to be a kind of Buddhist notion. I like quoting Einstein, and Einstein says, doesn't he, that, well, possibly you don't know, but you've probably heard me quote Einstein, and he says that wonder, this emotion of wonder, is the source of all true art and all true science. And he says that to the person in whom wonder is there, who cannot wonder, who doesn't experience wonder, their eyes are closed and they're as good as dead. Because wonder is, he thinks, the quintessential experience of being alive. There should be wonder all the time, that there is this universe around us. And when we're in touch with wonder, it's an intimation of this, it's what I'm talking about in terms of deep Shraddha. Okay, so next we have, that's deep faith, and we have lucid faith. Lucid faith. So lucid, lucid meaning clear. Lucid Shraddha is based on, in a way, a sense of knowing. So it's not so much an emotional counterpart as deep faith was, but it's a sense of knowing what has value. So you're clear about what has value in your life. What are your values in your life? What are you living for? And we're all sort of trying to grope around. We all have some values that we're trying to move towards, but often they're not very articulate, even to ourselves. Yeah, we kind of want to be happy, we want to be fulfilled, but if we try and think about it a little bit more specifically, often we're not very clear. Why am I actually pursuing the life that I'm pursuing? Yeah? So I was pursuing a career, and why was I doing that? And I was working really, really hard, and some of the time it was fun, a lot of the time it was really, really frustrating. It was, it was giving me a lot of money, but then I didn't have time to spend it, so what was I kind of doing? There was some value, probably, that I was trying to pursue, but I couldn't have articulated it fully to myself. And lucid Shraddha is when we see real value, and we have a response that, yes, these values are what I'm living by, or what I want to live by, what I want to do. Yeah. So for me, it was my first experience of retreat, where I think I experienced this lucidity. I heard more about the Dharma, I experienced something of it for myself, and it became very, very clear that this was the values that mattered, at least to me, they mattered. These were the central values. What I wasn't so clear about is what I did about that. Yeah, because my life was very, it was a bit of a mess at the time, so I wasn't clear as to what I was going to do, but there was a clarity about this was what I ought to be doing, this was what life was really about. And with that clarity came a certain sense of calm, in the sense that, at least I'd found what was important. I wasn't sure whether I was going to be able to pursue it, but a certain sort of calm confidence came with that clarity. So lucid Shraddha has the sense of calmness and a sense of confidence and a sense of You know your place in the world and the direction that you're moving. You know what you're doing with your life. You're not wandering around caught up in all the currents that you might find as you sort of plunge into something. You know, you're not swept around. You've got a direction. Yeah? The image that's sometimes used for lucid shraddha is the water purifying gem. So it's said that we're like a pool of muddy, turbulent water. Yeah. This time we're not a pot, we're a pool of water. And there's this magical gem that is dropped into the pool and it purifies the water. So all the mud settles, yeah, and the turbulence dies down, and there's this calm clarity. The water becomes calm and clear. And then it can reflect the sky. It can reflect the stars. It can reflect reality. And you can see. You can see clearly. So without that calm clarity, we're turbulent and we can't see the truth. Yeah? So lucid shraddha is sometimes said to be like the water purifying gem. So any questions so far on either on deep shraddha or lucid shraddha? Yeah. Yeah.
And then that might slip into a view.
Yeah.
And I can experience that in myself when I talk to my Christian friends and about spiritual matters, that I very easily, with my confidence, slip into a view at which the underlying thoughtfulness is that Buddhism is superior.
Right, yeah.
So, and can you say a bit about that, where you basically can make sure that that doesn't happen, or how to counter that, or...
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how one makes sure it doesn't happen, because
well,
it does, doesn't
it? Yeah, it does, yeah, but...
yeah,
I mean,
it does happen.
It,
that's right, that's right.
But,
Yeah. So I think that's an interesting thing, because it's the flip. It's not the flip side, but it's Shraddha has this certain quality of not knowing. Yeah. And what we can do, very often, is turn it into a hard knowing, an unhelpful sort of I understand. So Shraddha is this impulse to understand, and there are things to understand, and Buddhism does have some things to say that I think are superior to a lot of world views, and they're not ultimately it. They're pointers to an experience that can't be grasped. And if we grasp the view and think that we've understood, then we've lost touch with the spirit of Buddhism. Yeah. At the same time, if we're too timid to go with the view, then we won't actually follow it to change. Yeah. So Buddhism is not like a relativism. It's not saying that Hinduism is as good, or Christianity's views are as true, or any other religion is as true, or no religion, secular materialism is as true. Buddhism is saying no, Buddhism's true. Yeah. And the others might have aspects of truth in them, but they're not as true. And in fact, they're not going to be as helpful in the long run. Yeah? So Buddhism's quite clear about that. At the same time, Buddhism's saying, remember, that even Buddhist views are just a path. They're just provisional truth. They're not ultimate truth. We have to walk the path and experience the truth for ourselves. And ultimately, that experience lies beyond all conceptual views. As Maitreya Vandu was saying, the Buddha has no views. So Buddhist views are a tool. They're not ultimate truth. And sometimes we can start to take them as ultimate truth and even start to beat other people up with our ultimate truth. And then we're not particularly... We've lost touch with the notion of the spirit of it. There's something about understanding. We want to understand, but actually Shraddha is about being capable of resting in not understanding. Sangharakshita says that when we understand something, and I mean like intellectually understand something, it's almost like we become superior to it. So if I understand French or mathematics, it's like I've mastered something. Do you see what I mean? And one is superior to it. But when it comes to life and the truths of the universe and each other, we can't understand it like we can understand French or mathematics, because that puts us in a weird position. We're not superior to life or to each other in that certain sense. And if we think we understand Buddhism in that sense, then it becomes a barrier. Our very thinking that we've got it becomes a barrier. It just becomes another obstacle. At the same time, we should be striving to understand, but with humility. Humility that says, I don't really know. I don't really know who the Buddha is. I don't really know what Shraddha is. I don't really know what wisdom is. This is what the teaching tells me. In my experience, when I follow this teaching, well, I've had some sort of experiences that intimate that it might be true. Yeah? There's a sort of humility in that, as well as a confidence. Yeah? Does that help? A little bit. Okay, good. Well, I'll settle for a bit. Okay, so I want to move on to the last third, as it were, part of confidence, trust of Shraddha. So we've got deep faith, which is a sort of emotional conviction. We've got a lucid faith, which is more like an intellectual clarity. It's a clarity that says this is of value. Yeah. So it's a response to value. The deep faith is an emotional response to truth. Then longing faith. Now longing faith is saying that not only are there truths and values, but also that I can move towards them, that we can start to embody them, that we have the potential to become Buddhas. That's what Buddhism is saying. That's why the Buddha isn't like a god, because in a theistic tradition you can never become God. In Buddhism, you can. Well, you become a Buddha. You don't become God, you become Buddha. A Buddha. Yeah? And longing faith is that confidence that, yes, we can grow towards the ideal, that we've got that potential. And not only that we can, but we're doing so. So it's got a volitional component. I will move towards this ideal. I am moving towards this ideal. I can move towards this ideal. Yeah? So there it's very, very different from just a worship that says, fantastic, this ideal, but I'm little old me that is some sort of worm, and there's the Buddha. Longing faith is actually saying, no, I'm a potential Buddha. I can move towards what the Buddha was, yeah, and become what the Buddha was. We can all do that. So longing faith is, in a way, confidence in our own potential. And confidence also in the path that the Buddha laid out, in the Dharma, that the Dharma works if we practice it. Yeah? It's a path, not something that's a belief system that you just take on. It's a path that we practice. And longing faith, abhilasha, is that we want to move along that path. So these values and truths that we respond to become something incredibly desirable for us in our lives, and we're going to move towards them. So abhilasha, longing, is this beautiful quality of longing in this sense, of longing for the ideal, with confidence that we can attain it. That we can make progress. So if that is the volitional dimension of Shraddha, longing faith, you know, we will move towards something and we'll do something, then lucid faith, you could say, is the cognitive dimension of Shraddha, because it's a sort of knowing what is of value. And then deep faith is the emotional dimension of Shraddha, which is this response that's almost pre-knowing, that just knows truth. An emotional response to truth. So Shraddha in its fullness is everything. Well, it demands everything from us. It demands our emotions, our reason and our knowing faculty, as well as our volitions and our ways of being and acting. So Shraddha is a complete package, if you like, for a human being. All our all aspects of ourselves can be contained in this experience of Shraddha. And it's something that, as I say, is a path in itself. We can go on developing in Shraddha. And the more we develop in Shraddha, the closer we get to something that, in a way, can only be described as pranya, which is wisdom. It's when Shraddha becomes something that's completely part of our being, when actually we experience the truth and the value, and we become embodiments of that, that's when pranya arises. So do you see, it's quite different from, certainly from a Hindu, and probably from a Christian notion of you just believe this, but you can't test it for yourself. You can never know it for yourself, at least not in this life. And there's nothing else to kind of do. And if you don't believe, then you're damned, and you mustn't doubt, etc., etc. It's quite different. It's much more complete a response than that. At the same time, there is this acknowledgement that understanding in the ordinary sense isn't going to be enough. There is something much more mysterious going on. And the appropriate response is wonder and awe and humility in the face of that. So how do you think we can do this? How do you think we can cultivate Shraddha? I've just said quite glibly that Shraddha can be cultivated. It's a path. You can deepen it. We've already got the potential. In a way, it's innate in us. How would we cultivate it? If you wanted to do so deliberately, in this Buddhist sense, what could you do? If you've been paying attention, Maitreya Bandhu and I have been giving you clues all evening.
So in a practical sense, you go back to the Dharma, you keep listening and reading.
Yeah, exactly. So you can keep listening and reflecting on the Dharma. That would be one way, it would be one way of developing Shraddha and deepening it. Because if you don't know what the Dharma says, or if we haven't reflected on it enough, our confidence in it is going to be very shallow. So listening and reflecting, studying.
Ethics.
Yeah. Can you say why? I think you're right, but...
So last week's lessons were Buddhism to help for ethics. Ethics feeds meditation.
Yeah.
Meditation feeds ethics.
Exactly. And ethics is when we try and live from a skillful life. Ethics is about values, isn't it? It's about values. And when we're trying to live ethically, we're living accordance to values, in accordance with certain values. And so even to try and do that is to acknowledge that those values have significance, that they're important. And then as we try and live more and more ethically, or act more and more ethically, we strengthen our conviction in those values. So not only are they just abstractly important, not only is kindness just an abstract quality, it becomes something that we're trying to actually embody. And so we strengthen our conviction in that. Particularly if we then reflect on our experience and notice that acting skillfully makes us happier. So ethical, in a way, the path starts with ethics. And ethics, in a way, is the whole of the path. Meditation, you could say, is a way of deepening ethics. And pranya is a way when we, in a way, you could say, it's when we realise that those values are part of the nature of reality. They're not just a good idea, but somehow... kindness, metta, is pointing to the nature of reality. So, in a way, the whole of the path is a deepening of ethics. Yeah. Any other thoughts about how we cultivate shraddha? Yeah.
To question it and challenge it and check it all the time.
Oh, yeah, that's right. In this way of healthy doubt that you were talking about, of really testing our own assumptions, our own experience, and what the Dharma tells us about the truth and life. That's right. Yeah. And interestingly, that questioning, as I've just said, involves questioning ourselves. Yeah. What are the assumptions that I'm already bringing to this teaching, for example? What am I already bringing? And one way of thinking about meditation is that it helps us to get to know ourselves better, and so we can start to know more consciously those assumptions that we bring to our life, the attitudes that we bring, the histories. Maitreyavandhu said there are other histories, and through meditation we can start to know ourselves and know what those attitudes and histories are. Yeah? So questioning isn't just, in Buddhism, we are the path. So that's where it differs from science. In science, we don't have to question ourselves. Yeah, we just pick up the test tube or whatever you do, and there's an experiment to follow. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. In Buddhism, we are performing the experiment on ourselves. So we have to question ourselves and our assumptions and our state of mind. We are both the doer of the experiment and the subject of the experiment, and we are the path. So the state of mind, the attitude that we bring, affects the results. Yeah, that's why there's this pot analogy. If we're a cracked pot, a leaky pot, or a poisoned pot, meditation or whatever ethics won't work, because the mind is already not in a state to pursue the path. Yeah. So what we've had is ethics. We've had listening and reflecting to the Dharma. We've had questioning. And in a way, that goes with the reflecting. Yeah? A healthy questioning. Any other thoughts? Yeah. Yeah, great, great. So ritual and devotion can be a way of strengthening our confidence, our conviction in values. And why is that? Why is that? Well, I think it's because we need to be moved. You know, the first faith was this deep conviction. Yeah, it's hard, I think, to be moved in that deep emotional way by just abstract ideas. And if we're not careful, our assumption of Buddhism or our understanding of Buddhism will just remain on some sort of intellectual level. And that's not going to be enough to move us, to really change our lives. So Buddhism says it's not enough just to have an abstract idea of wisdom, for example, or of kindness, or of energy, or of purity. What moves us is stories, and what moves us is images and people. Yeah, myth moves us. So, you know, I went to the Globe last weekend. I saw Romeo and Juliet. I know the story. I've seen it before. And in a certain sense, it's sort of ridiculous. But Shakespeare turns what could have been just a cliché kind of story into something that transcends itself, into deep insights about the nature of human beings and the human condition. And it's moving. It's moving in a way that if I just said to you, love can transcend death, well, that's still an idea. You see it enacted. You see enacted with two lovers dying for each other and the effect that it has on their families and the whole city and the beauty of that tragedy, and it moves you. Yeah? So ritual and devotion has a similar effect to art and theatre and imagination. It can move us. And you know, on the shrine we've got this image of Vajrasattva. These Buddhist images are personifications of enlightened qualities. So they're not like literal beings, so much as symbols of forces in the enlightened mind. And Vajrasattva is particularly an image of wisdom conjoined with compassion and the purity of the enlightened mind, a purity of shunyata. That's why we've got him on the shrine, because he is the purity of shunyata. Not the purity that's just good in the sense that when you get up, when you help somebody over the road, sort of good. It's not that sort of thing. It's that, but purity that sees things as they really are and has no obscuration of self that gets in the way, nothing that gets in the way of reality, completely transparent to reality. So Vajrasattva is an image for that state of mind. He's beautiful. He's beautiful. He's shining, radiant white. It's said to be like the so radiant that it's like sunlight shining on snow. And I like to think of that as scintillating white that scintillates with all the colours of the rainbow. So he's clothed in rich jewels and ornaments because purity is such a rich, blissful experience. So you've got images like that. And yes, faith and devotion can... ritual can help us connect with those values and want us to move towards them. One more, and then I want to finish.
Yeah, I've got a sort of side question about
it. Yeah.
We can gain very positive sort of insights and sensibilities from life without Buddhism.
Yeah.
That are the same. So we can become very patient.
That's
true. And we can be full of sort of the right kinds of doubts.
Yeah.
And full of wonder, like Einstein.
He
wasn't a Buddhist, but we can learn from his insights, and they can help. You know, in the right hands, they can
be amazing.
So, I mean, I think. That's a problem for me, and I imagine it's a problem for people here. Maybe not a lot of people here, but some people here. That they to get Shraddha into our lives. How do you know? I know that you said sort of, there are certain ways, but I haven't made sense of any of those ways yet.
Well, you don't have to. In a way, Buddhism isn't saying that it's. The only way of developing these qualities, of Buddhist qualities. What it is it's a set of practices and tools that can help us develop those qualities. And there are other tools and practices, like the arts, for example. So you might not connect with ritual, but you might connect with the arts in some way, or with nature in some way. And that too can help us develop some of these qualities. Or our human relationships, friendships, can help us develop patience, for example.
But they can also stop us. They can help us develop the same things, because if you find the same things in a different bracket, they can actually, that bracket can be a barrier to a lot of sort of Buddhist. That's what I'm finding, to a lot of a Buddhist approach. I'm just curious about how one overcomes that bracket if you're getting the same trigger from somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, in a way, you have to see if it works. You have to test it in the end. And if, for example, another packet of cereal works for you, do you see what I mean? Then that's fine. I think that's where you have to test it. And for me, not just for me. You can only test it by really trying it for a while. So try meditation, try going on retreat, read about Buddhism, reflect on it, and then compare it with other things. So look, I want to finish here, but I want to finish coming back to this image of Vajrasattva on the shrine in a ritual way. I want to finish in a ritual way as a way to see if we can go beyond just the ideas that we've been discussing. Let them, in a way, not let them go, but see if there's some way of transcending them just by responding to an image. And just in this case, by responding to a mantra. So we're going to chant the mantra that is associated with Vajrasattva. When you chant the mantra, you're evoking the ideal that Vajrasattva represents in our own lives. So the mantra of Vajrasattva is long, and I'm not going to lead us through it. Maybe next week or something I'll say more about it. So we'll chant it three times. We'll chant it three times. If you don't know it, just listen. And if you know it, join in. Yeah? So I'm talking about the 100-syllable Vajrasattva mantra. We'll sit for 30 seconds or so, then I'll start us off and just join in if you know the mantra. So if you can see the image of Vajrasattva, you might want to look at it. Or you might just want to close your eyes and see if you can imagine this radiant white light that's scintillating with all the colours of the rainbow. This light that is said to be like sunlight on snow. If you can, you could imagine being bathed in that light. So much so that the light permeates into you. Starts to fill the whole of your body. And the light is not just beautiful, but it has value and meaning. It's the light of wisdom. The Vajrasattva mantra. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tvenopatishta Dridho me bhava Sutoshyo me bhava Suposhyo me bhava Anartho me bhava Sarva siddhi me pecha Sarva karma sucha me Chitam Shriya Kuru Om Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tathagata Vajramame Muncha Vajri Bhava Mahasamya Sattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tvenopatishta Dritho me bhava Sutoshyo me bhava Suposhyo me bhava Anartho me bhava Sarva siddhi me pecha Sarva karma sucha me Chitam Shriya Kuru Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tathagata Vajraname Muncha Vajri Bhava Mahasamya Sattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tvenopatishta
Maha Samyasattva.